Between 1932 and 1933 in Ukraine, nearly 4 million people died of starvation. In what became known as the Holodomor, which means literally the hunger death, these Ukrainians were deliberately starved by the Soviet state. However, famine was only one weapon of war used by Stalin because while peasants were dying in the countryside, Soviet secret police simultaneously launched attacks on the Ukrainian intellectual and political elites, neutering any Ukrainian challenge to Soviet power. Now, according to my next guest, the famine was later denied, covered up by Soviet authorities, who were determined that not only Ukraine should abandon its national aspirations, but that the country's history should be buried along with its victims. Anne Applebaum, columnist with the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of Gulag, a history of the Soviet camps, and the National Book Award finalist for Iron Curtain, the crushing of Eastern Europe. Anne's also professor of practice at the London School of Economics Institute of Global Affairs. And as we well know from the 2014 Maidan Revolution, the fleeing of Viktor Yanukovych, and the Russian invasion of Eastern Ukraine, Ukrainian independence remains an ongoing issue for the Russian state. Anne's latest is called Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine, published by Alan Lane. And I welcomed her back to the program.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And the famine of 32-33 was effectively silenced by the Soviet for decades, but it must resonate in the thinking of both Ukrainians and Russians today.
Yes, it does, in all kinds of unexpected ways. The point about it having been silenced is very important because it's a story that Ukrainians knew. They passed it down from generation to generation. Children learned about it from their grandparents. It happened in the 30s, but people knew about it in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And one of the interesting things is that in the 1980s, when perestroika began in the Soviet Union, one of the first issues that came up in Ukraine as something that people wanted to talk about was the famine and was the assault on the Ukrainian intelligentsia and political class that accompanied it. And that conversation about the famine and about the attacks on Ukrainian national figures was one of the things that led, that inspired really the Ukrainian drive for independence that resulted in an independent Ukraine in 1991. And, you know, an independent Ukraine in 1991 was one of the things that broke up the Soviet Union.
Isn't it extraordinary that the country's history should be buried along with its victims so successfully?
It was buried very, very, very successfully in that the census statistics were first repressed and then later manipulated. The famine was never discussed in public. There was a lot of pressure placed on Western journalists. I described that in the book, not to write about it. And there was huge efforts were made to keep it silent. But the point is that when the effect of that silence was that when people began talking about it, it became very explosive. And because it was one of the things that inspired the independence movement and that continues to make Ukrainians think differently about their country today, it remains a kind of political football between Ukraine and Russia. It's something that people still talk about and argue about even now.
And let's walk back to the Soviet policies of agricultural collectivization. Clearly, a factor in the conditions for the famine.
Yes, absolutely. So the collectivization was a way to force peasants to leave their farms, to abandon their own property, and to join state farms. And the point of it was both to sort of proletarianize the peasants so that they would be easier to control. And also, I think Stalin believed that it would be more efficient. There would be, you know, larger farms, and he wanted the farms to be state-owned and not private. And so that he didn't like the idea that there would be in the Soviet Union large private farms, because that would you know, create landlords and so on. And collectivization was, first of all, resisted, I think, to a degree that we hadn't really understood until archives were available. And there was actually armed resistance to it, especially in Ukraine. So people went into their barns and they dug up the weapons they'd used during the Civil War a decade earlier, and they started shooting commissars. And this was, of course, set off all kinds of alarm bells in Moscow. And there was a real struggle between the peasants all over the Soviet Union, but especially in Ukraine, and the commissars who wanted to, and the activists who wanted to make collectivization work. And of course, one of the side effects of it was it created this terrible chaos and disorganization in the whole agricultural economy, which in a way they never recovered.
I remember from my Communist Party days that Marx did not regard peasants as a class, but Lenin was a bit more pragmatic. He saw them as having potential.
Yes, he saw them as potentially revolutionary, which of course was good and bad, because he saw that, well, if you could get them revolutionary on our side, it's all right. But of course, they could be revolutionary on somebody else's behalf. And they were worried about that. And Stalin was particularly worried about that, because during the Civil War, the Ukrainian peasantry had indeed staged a massive anti-Bolshevik revolution, rebellion rather. And so they had a memory of having fought against Ukrainian peasants in 1918 and 1919, and that stuck with them. That was in the back of their heads when they were conducting the collectivization drives in 1930.
Before we push on with the story, the famine must have had wider consequences across the Soviet than the Ukraine.
Oh, yes, of course. No, there was a – it's important to understand that there was a Soviet famine, and it had terrible effects also, for example, in Kazakhstan, where for separate reasons there was also very high death levels. And it had very strong effects in some parts of Russia as well. But it was a catastrophe, and it affected the cities. There were food shortages in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But there was a moment in the autumn of 1932 when Stalin decided to use this mass famine, this moment of chaos, which was actually, you know, could have been a disaster for him politically, to end this problem in Ukraine, you know, to get rid of the peasant problem that he saw as constantly festering, and then subsequently followed by an attack on the Ukrainian national class, national intellectuals.
So let us re-emphasize that Stalin didn't seek to eliminate all Ukrainians, but only the politically active. And I was shocked to learn from you that many Ukrainian communists collaborated with this appalling project.
Yes, no, Ukrainian communists. Well, it's an odd thing. There were actually many of the leading Ukrainian communists actually wrote to Stalin over the summer in 1932 and warned him there was this terrible famine coming. And he made it clear that he wasn't going to listen to them. And then later on, they collaborated. And also at a much lower level, there were it's hard to know what to call them. There were all kinds of local activists who joined in, people who came from both from Russia and from the Ukrainian cities, who carried out a requisition drive. And this actually is how the famine happened in Ukraine. So it wasn't just chaos and it wasn't just, you know, bad planning. It was teams of activists who went into the villages and went from house to house and literally took people's food away. So they took all their food, not just wheat, but, you know, beets and corn and sometimes farm animals and whatever else they had, and they confiscated it. And then people were left with nothing. And at the same time, a kind of cordon was drawn around Ukraine. Peasants were not allowed to leave Ukraine. And there were blockades put up between the villages and the cities so that people couldn't go to the cities in search of food. And that was really how the famine happened in Ukraine. It happened because of the requisitions and then the roadblock.
Okay, back in the 30s, the term genocide was either not in wide use or perhaps had yet to be coined, but you apply it, don't you?
Yes. No, the word genocide is not invented until later. It was invented actually by a Polish-Jewish lawyer named Raphael Lemkin, who grew up in what is now Western Ukraine and had the regions history very much in the forefront of his mind when he was creating the concept, which became a part of international law. His original idea was that genocide meant exactly what this assault on Ukraine was. In other words, it was an assault on a nation as a nation, an attempt to eliminate it. It wasn't just murder. It was also a cultural assault. It was a destruction of the language, or a repression of the language, a destruction of cultural institutions, churches, and so on. And that was exactly what happened in Ukraine. As it became translated into international law, it's come to be treated a little bit, people are very wary of the term international lawyers, and they really only want to apply it very narrowly.
Soviets did everything they could to keep it off that list.
Exactly. So the Soviet Union was actually part of writing the international law. It wrote the UN Convention on Genocide in the 1940s, and it was very anxious that incidents like the Ukrainian famine not be applicable, not the law wouldn't apply to them. And the law sort of came to be understood in international law as something like the Holocaust, where it's an attempt to murder everybody in a particular ethnic group. Nevertheless, our instinctive understanding of what genocide is, in other words, that you try to kill people because of who they are, because of what group they belong to, I think absolutely applies to the Ukrainian famine. And I have no difficulty with the word being used.
Let's move on. Following the 2004 Orange Revolution, Viktor Yushchenko was the first president elected without a communist pedigree. And he tried to promote the study of the famine.
He did. He put it as at the center of kind of Ukrainians, national politics. He also began pushing for the recognition of the famine as a genocide. He made that part of Ukrainian foreign policy. Some people on both sides of the argument found that controversial, because there are people who felt he put too much stress on it. They wanted Ukraine's national identity to be built on positive things and not just on this negative tragedy. But the one thing he did do that was very positive is he funded quite a lot of historical research, quite a lot of efforts to collect existing material, oral history, so much so that there's really a tremendous amount of information available. And I should say an interesting point is that although his successor, the much more pro-Russian president, Yanukovych, changed the tone of conversation, he actually never stopped he never prevented the historical work from going on, and he didn't stop, he didn't shut the archives or anything like that, which is what's something that happened in Russia. So the research into the famine that Yushchenko's politics inspired has gone on and produced really a tremendous amount of material in the last decade or two.
Following the famine in the 30s, Soviet leaders pushed back very harshly against Ukrainian nationalism, but also Sovietization often took the form of Russification. Explain what you mean by that.
So, it's very simple. So Russification in the wake of the famine meant many things. It meant that there were actually Russians were brought into empty Ukrainian territories and told to and offered given the farms that had been recently owned by Ukrainians who had died. So there was some actual repopulation of Ukraine that was done with Russians. There was a lot of pressure put on the Ukrainian language, so people were discouraged from using it, discouraged from teaching it. Essentially, in Ukraine, in the Ukrainian Soviet Republic, after the 30s, if you wanted to get ahead, if you wanted a higher degree, if you wanted to be in the government, if you wanted an important job, you had to speak Russian. And Russian became the most important language of administration and government. Certainly in the cities, most people, ambitious people spoke Russian. And Ukrainian was kind of demoted. It was a secondary language. It wasn't the main language of the state. It wasn't the main language of politics or of industry. And that was a deliberate policy. It was done to lessen the influence both of the Ukrainian national movement and to force Ukraine to Sovietize, to blend in more easily with the rest of the Soviet Union, and particularly with Russia.
Let's go back in time now, and let's go back to 1917. What was the response in Ukraine to the revolution? It was fairly extraordinary, was it not?
Well, the Ukraine had its own revolution. We often forget, you know, there was more than one revolution in 1917. There was the one in February, which was initially a liberal revolution, and then there was the Bolshevik coup in October. And in that year, there was a Ukrainian national revolution as well, and a group of, liberal national Ukrainian, mostly intellectuals, created what they called the Central Rada, a kind of central council. They began trying to hold elections in the very chaotic conditions that there were. And their idea was that they should have a Ukrainian state, something like the Polish state that was also recreated at that time, or Czechoslovakia, or any of the other numerous new states that there were in Central Europe in that year. And they wanted their aim was to have a Ukrainian state as well. Almost immediately, they were caught up in the Russian Civil War, and they were at war with the Bolsheviks, and they were overthrown once, and then another version of the Ukrainian state emerged, and they were overthrown a second time, and there was actually a period of so much chaos there in 1918. There were the statistic is that there were – the city of Kiev was occupied 12 times by different armies, you know, Red Army, White Army, Ukrainian armies. The Poles came in at one point, Pilsudski's army, and there was real chaos in Ukraine. And, of course, this is the moment of chaos and the moment of this, you know, anti-Bolshevik rebellion that Stalin remembered so clearly 10 years later.
Now, let me make sure I get this. In January 1918, Ukraine declared independence, and to some extent, this was recognized. Even the U.S. sent a diplomat.
In 1918, yes. No, the U.S. sent a diplomat. There were Ukrainians who appeared at Ukrainian sort of foreign policy diplomats who appeared at international conferences. There were people were beginning to open embassies in Kiev. There was an idea that maybe, you know, just as remember the Austro-Hungarian Empire was breaking up at this point into separate states. And even the Russian Empire was also breaking up. Remember, the Baltic states had been part of the Russian Empire, and they gained their independence in 1918. So to many, it seemed very possible that Ukraine would succeed as well. But because of the military situation and because of the lots of reasons, but partly because of the weakness of the Ukrainian national movement, they lost. And they lost to the Bolsheviks. They lost to the Red Army, which finally conquered Ukraine in really, it was only really conquered by 1920, 1921.
Now, Stalin had expressed his thoughts that, quote, nationalism was a distraction from socialism and that comrades must work against the fog of nationalism, but they also changed their minds, didn't they, about this at different times, Stalin, Lenin?
Yes. So, no, nationalism, Lenin saw the uses of nationalism. You know, he saw that it was something that could motivate people. And, of course, Stalin later saw the uses of it. And during World War II, he famously used Russian national symbols and language to inspire people to fight for their motherland against the Nazis. So they certainly weren't above using the same ideas themselves. And of course, later on, I mean, for example, the Polish communists were constantly trying to refer to Polish nationalism, to Polish national symbols, to convince people that they were really Polish and not a foreign import. So actually, communist parties generally had a kind of it was a very cynical and opportunistic attitude towards nationalism. Sometimes it's useful to us, and sometimes it's not. And in the case of Ukraine, they very much disliked Ukrainian nationalism because they saw that it was, first of all, it was anti-Bolshevik, and second of all, its aim was to break Ukraine off from Russia, which they, for both economic and political reasons, were very much afraid of.
LNL on RN Summer and downloadable onto your ABC Listen app. And you're listening to Anne Applebaum, the award-winning journalist, author and historian. And we're discussing her book, Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine. I'd forgotten that Stalin's first job after the Bolshevik coup in 1917 was as People's Commissar for Nationalities.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. This was his issue. He thought a lot about it. He spent a lot of time in Ukraine in 1917, 1819, and in southern Russia as well, in one famous incident in Tsaritsyn, a town that later became known as Stalingrad. And he followed very carefully the course of the civil war in southern Russia and Ukraine. And so, and it was he, you know, he had a kind of hyper awareness both of the power of the Ukrainian national movement, but also a particular memory of how anti-Bolshevik it had been. You know, the Ukrainian peasants in the Ukrainian national movement, it's interesting to note, was what we would now call a left-wing movement. It was, they were in favor of land reform. They wanted to redistribute land to the present peasants. They were radical economically, but they weren't Bolsheviks, you know, and they were anti-Moscow, and they were anti-Kremlin, and they were anti the Soviet Communist Party. And that made them particularly dangerous because they had this kind of radical left-wing appeal, the Ukrainian national movement, but they didn't want to be part of the Soviet Union. And that made them very dangerous because there were other movements like that in the Soviet Union too.
As you point out, the link between food and power was all too well understood by the Bolsheviks, wasn't it? In fact, the Bolshevik obsession with food began in World War I, and they'd struggled with food supplies ever since.
Well, I mean, earlier than that, I mean, the Russian Revolution, the first revolution in February 1917, which led to the Tsar's abdication, was caused by food riots. All through World War I, the Russian state had difficulty feeding the population of the big cities. And one of the things that panicked Lenin the most was the idea that there would be more food revolutions and that they would, you know, the people of St. Petersburg, or rather Leningrad as it became, would throw him out of power for the same reasons. And they, their economics were, their initial economic policy was so chaotic and was so destructive of food distribution systems that all through the first years, really through the 1930s and even later, they had terrible problems distributing food and getting food to people. And actually, this lasted until the very end of the Soviet Union. But it was an obsession of Lenin. He sent angry telegrams to the Ukrainian front, you know, calling on the Red Army, you know, whatever you do, for God's sake, bring us grain. We need grain in St. Petersburg.
A Ukrainian called Schlichter, the People's Commissar of Food Collection, instigated a class war by making distinctions between the peasants, which hadn't really existed before. And he came up with the term kulak, which I once again vividly recall from my Commo party days. This is to denigrate wealthy peasants and pitting them against the poorest. Did that work?
So I'm not sure that he invented the word kulak, but he certainly used it, and he was one of several people to use it at that time. And of course, then it went into wider use. And you're absolutely right that the purpose of it was to divide people, so that to create a kind of sense of class war in the villages, which you'd had in the cities, but not in the countryside, and to pit the poorer peasants against the rich ones. And so the kulaks were the rich peasants, and the idea was that the poor peasants would join into these poor peasants' committees, and they would requisition the grain of the rich peasants, and then they would send it to Moscow. And that was the purpose of what he was doing in these early days. Later on, the term kulak was used again during collectivization, and it began to be a term that didn't even really necessarily mean rich people. It meant anybody who opposed collectivization, anybody who opposed the Soviet state could be accused of being a kulak. And in 1930, when they did this collectivization, the kulaks were actually arrested and deported. And so hundreds of thousands of people actually were taken out of their homes, and some were sent to different parts of the Soviet Union, some were sent to the Gulag. And the term kulak became it was almost that it was a scapegoat. You know, whatever's wrong, why don't we have any food? It's because the kulaks have taken our food away from us.
Let's now introduce another term, Cheka. Now, this is the first Soviet secret police, and you argue that their foundation was also about food.
Yes. So the Cheka were founded in this hysterical moment of 1918, this moment when Lenin declared something called the Red Terror. And that was a moment when the Cheka were created, they weren't a normal police force. They were a special police force. And they were sent out to arrest anybody who belonged to a political party that wasn't the Bolsheviks, anybody who was considered to be an enemy. But they were also – one of the reasons why they were created was to help in this process of emergency grain requisition, you know, to get people to hand over their grain and send it to Moscow, because that was the emergency consideration in 1918 and 19, again, because the cities didn't have food and because Lenin knew that the 1917 revolution had happened because of food shortages.
What long-term effect did the Bolshevik policies, the failed collectivization, the use of forced labor, as well as the wars, have on the economy, the trade, the industry within Ukraine?
Well, I mean, that's a question you could ask about the whole Soviet Union. You know, over the long term, Soviet economic policy impoverished the Soviet Union. I mean, you could see it in the 30s and you could see it in the 70s. The state farms were never as productive as private farms would have been. There was enormous amount of waste. People spent a lot of time cheating the system rather than working for it. And this was true in the farms, and it was true in the factories, and it was true in almost every aspect of the economy. It was fantastically inefficient. It was bureaucratic. And it was, you know, it was organized by this very awkward, inefficient system of central planning, you know, in which people would sit in Moscow and try to decide in advance, you know, how many widgets were going to be bought and sold in the year 1963 and who was going to produce them and who was going to sell them.
And it's a tragedy, of course, that Mao didn't learn enough of the lesson, and that some of this was replicated in China. But then towards the end, there was a desperate attempt to hybridize agriculture so that farmers could also produce some private crops, and that tended to be, you know, quite successful.
Yeah, no, well, that actually, I mean, the farmers were given bits of plots of land even earlier, in a way just to make sure that people stayed fed and had enough food to feed their children and so that they didn't leave the countryside. But there were a number of attempts in the later years to create a hybrid, I mean, at the very end, really, to create a hybrid system. But I think by that time it was too late.
So famine comes back again and again. 1921, a dreadful famine, and there was the Great Famine of 1932. Did the Soviets ever ask for international aid?
So the interesting thing is, yes, they did in 1921. There was a major drive for aid, and there was a very famous, actually, American aid effort led by Herbert Hoover, who organized it. And that was the only moment when there were American operatives all over the Soviet Union handing out grain, or all over the Soviet Union, certainly in the parts of Russia and Ukraine that had famine. But it was not done again, and it was not done in 1932. In fact, as we've discussed, the famine was not publicized. It was not mentioned. It was not discussed anywhere. And it was knowledge of it was repressed. And so there was no aid asked for then. There was also another famine after the war immediately after the war in 1946. And that too was never, there was no call for international aid then either. It never happened again.
Okay. Many survivors, you're right that if a family was alive, and this is talking 1932, that meant that it had food. And if they had food, then they should have given it up. And if they'd failed to give it up, they were kulaks, Polish agents or enemies. This is as the committees and brigades traveled around trying to confiscate food. Just being alive attracted suspicion.
Yes. No, I mean, during this moment of high, you know, paranoia and tension in Ukraine, in the winter of 1932-33, when these activist teams were going into the villages, one of the things they were looking for was who was still eating. And if you were eating anything, then you were a kulak. You must be hiding something. And so then your house was searched and your food was taken away. There's a colleague of mine, a very good young Ukrainian historian, has written a book using the huge oral history record and other documents of this on describing exactly how these activist teams worked. And her book is called Why Are You Still Alive?
Pasternak wrote about such an inhuman, unimaginable misery, such terrible disaster that it began to seem almost abstract. It would not fit within the bounds of consciousness. And Malcolm Muggeridge, an old friend of mine, oddly enough, after visiting, predicted that nobody would believe what was happening. And, of course, plenty of modern Russians still don't believe it ever happened.
No, many modern Russians don't believe it, if it even crosses their consciousness. I mean, it's not a topic of discussion in Russia, and which is a shame because it would help explain Ukraine to Russians. You know, it would be very useful for Russians to have some understanding that Ukrainian history has this side of it, has this story that Ukrainians remember. And generally, it would be important for Russians to understand you know, what Ukraine's grievance is. I mean, I think there would be a lot better, if the history were better known between the two countries, there would be better overall relations.
The voice of Anne Applebaum, the author of Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine, published by Alan Lane. Catch you later.